Thank you, Rob, for this very instructive introduction. And I guess it's also my pleasure to welcome all of us to the new semester. And I would also like to express my heartfelt thanks to IKGF for the opportunity to work here with such pleasant colleagues and such wonderful facilities, and I'm really delighted to be here. What I'm going to talk about today is a background study for my current project titled Aspects of Autonomy. As you can tell from the title of the last book, we're always told to, you know, do the project and then apply for the grant. Well, but this is actually a new and related subject, and this is a background study on the relation of Ming or ideas of fate to the boundary between humans and animals. That is, we tend to think of fate as something unique to humans. I want to problematize that idea, but I also want to put the question of fate in a broader question of how the relations of humans and animals are conceived in early China and Greece. And obviously, I'm not going to get through such a topic in the time allotted, and I will probably have to pull the plug on myself at some point. All right. Now, I want to first turn, then, to several Chinese and Greek accounts of continuity between humans and animals, of which the notion of having a fate is one. And we can look at three different approaches to this continuity, in particular in the Zhuangzi, the great Taoist texts, that bear on the boundary between humans and animals. One is the idea of Ming, fate or destiny, as living out a lifespan, Sheng Ming, which is in some sense allotted. Since animals as humans have lifespan, there's nothing too counterintuitive of this. Secondly, the idea that Ming is not restricted to humans. And thirdly, the notion of recommendations about what we should do about Ming, including enhancing our Ming by transforming our qi. Among the Chinese texts that I've surveyed, the notion of non-humans having a Ming or something like it, as far as I can tell, is unique to the Zhuangzi, like many other things in early Chinese philosophy. So I'm going to concentrate on that text. Now, an unusual discourse in the Zhuangzi describes destiny or Ming in the biological sense of lifespan, shengming, allotments, fun, and years allotted by heaven, tiannian. What's striking is the insistence that Ming is not limited to humans. This account of Ming suggests an appreciation of what in modern terms we might call a shared biological heritage between humans and animals. The Zhuangzi uses the terms Ming and Fun to name an allotment that governs the lifespans of living things. So it says, and these references here are to the Zhuangzi, that life and death are degreed, Ming, that there are regularities of night and day, and that this is heaven. Everything in which people cannot intervene is the nature of living things. And some of these terms, especially Qing, there's a lot of scholarly discourse about what it means, which for my purposes I'm not going to be able to engage in, with apologies. In another account, Ming is part of the origin of the world. The one arose from the nameless nothing and had no form. When what has not yet acquired form had allotments, fun, it was called Ming. The Zhuangzi also links Ming to the theme of uselessness, a very prominent and important theme in the Zhuangzi, arguing that plants whose wood is useful to humans are cut down and cut off from living their full lifespan. For example, the cassia or lacquer. People all know the uses of the useful, but no one knows the uses of the useless, including preserving one's own life. Now, what sort of uselessness? In some cases, an entire species is useless. For example, the chu or ailanthus tree, which is big but useless to the carpenter. In other cases, the uselessness is particular to a given individual. An ancient tree, for example, that is too gnarled for the carpenter, and which is then left on the mountain to live out its allotted lifespan. On another account, trees such as the hawthorn, pear, orange, and pomelo, and other cultivated trees, are stripped as soon as their fruits ripen. In this sense, then, their capacity, that is to produce these fruits, embitters their lives, and they do not live out their tianyan, their heaven-allotted years, but die prematurely, midlife by the axe, and bring on themselves the destruction of the world's custom. Then it adds, interestingly, there is no living thing for which it is not like this. In another passage, again, we get this same phrase, they do not live out their heaven-allotted years, tianyan, but in midlife die prematurely by the axe. This is the harm caused by talent or usefulness, tsai. So here we have this linkage of uselessness, a very common theme in the Zhuangzi, with this idea of being cut off artificially and unnaturally, if we may say, from one's natural lifespan. With the implication that all living things have a tianyan, some kind of an allotted lifespan. Now notice this isn't the term ming, the standard term of destiny, but we also need to remember that a word isn't a concept. So we have an analogous concept here. The Zhuangzi continues, this one is speaking of a gnarled and ancient tree, suppose that I had been useful, could I have attained my present size? And furthermore, you and I are both living things, should one treat another this way? So here's the suggestion that this cutting things off, cutting off their destinies, is not a nice thing to do. And it seems to be only humans, by the way, that do it. That is, animals kill other animals for food or whatever. But it's humans that cut other living things off from their natural lifespans. In a somewhat different vein, the Zhuangzi also suggests that some humans, spirit people, shenren, have cultivated a distinctive ability to enhance or prolong their lives. When spirit people bring about or cause to arrive their Ming and exhaust their Qing or their natures, heaven and earth are pleased, and their myriad concerns diminish and disappear. These passages then attribute Ming as lifespan or destiny to humans, to plants and animals. Now, the Zhuangzi, interestingly, does not ever seem to attribute Ming to gods or spirits, as opposed to spirit people, or to conscious or dead ancestors. Ming thus seems to be constrained to mortals. And there's an interesting potential comparison here with Greek material that time doesn't permit, but maybe we can put a bookmark for discussions in the hallway. Spirits, however, are not mortal, and ancestors no longer are mortal. Mortality, however, is shared by humans, animals, and plants, that is, by living things. Now, these passages also seem to treat lifespan as an upward limit. Sorry, I pushed the button too soon. Rather than a predetermined quantity. If lifespan were predetermined, there would be no use in being useless, would there? It would be all predetermined ahead of time. The trees that die midlife and don't live out their heaven-allotted years would simply be fulfilling their Ming, whereas the rhetoric of these passages seem to suggest that something is wrong when they're cut off this way. Instead, the Zhuangzi laments the utility that kills them before the upward limit is reached. Now, understanding Ming as having lifespan among its meanings also nuances a continuum, then, between human and animal in the Zhuangzi. By juxtaposing the allotments of Ming and the natural lifespans allotted by heaven, that is, Tianyan, we see a continuum in the fates of living things. This locates our human decisions within a natural continuum of living things. And I use the word natural with caution because it's not at all clear that there's a notion of nature in early China, but that's another topic that time does not permit digressing on. So on this account, natural lifespans are determined by several factors. One is the norm for a species. And again, we don't have Chinese text that talks about it in this way, but we can adduce it. For example, we learn in the Zhuangzi that the morning mushroom lives for a day, whereas the long-lived trees of southern Chu live for centuries. And I'm omitting the references here, but you can find them or you can ask me if you want to get them. But each individual also has a Ming, as distinct from the normal lifespan of a species. An individual Ming, an individual lifespan, which is subject to circumstance and also possibly to intervention. Animals also have allotted lifespans, but presumably lack the human ability to enhance their Ming by deliberate self-cultivation or other strategies. Humans differ then from animals and plants in that human lifespans may be determined not by class membership, but by individual circumstances, decision, and agency. Only humans make deliberate decisions, as far as we know, make deliberate choices that optimize our means. And only spirit people, it would appear, really get it right. Now, a very different account. I'm going to switch away from Ming now and to switch to a somewhat different account of the continuity between humans and animals. I'm now going to turn to the Liezi, a complex Taoist or quasi-Taoist text. And again, there are many dating and composition issues that time does not permit going into here. This is a long passage that I'm going to, alas, rush through in the interests of time. There are ways in which the intelligence of beasts and birds is by nature similar to humans. They wish as much as we do to preserve their lives and do not have to borrow wisdom from humans to do so. In remotest antiquity, they, that is, animals and birds, lived together with humans and we walked side by side. In the time of the five emperors, the animals were frightened away and scattered for the first time. In our own degenerate times, they crouch in hiding and flee to their lairs to avoid harm. Even now, in the country of Jie in the East, there are many who understand the speech of the six kinds of domestic animal. And even our own limited knowledge admits of this. The divine sages of remotest antiquity knew the habits of all the myriad things, interpreted the cries of the different species. They called them together for meetings and gave them instructions in the same way as human beings. So the fact that the sages first called together the ghosts, the spirits, and the chime, next summoned human beings of the eight quarters, and finally assembled birds, beasts, and insects, says, and here's the point, that there are no great differences in the mind and intelligence of all the kinds, all the lay, all the classifications made of blood and chi. And the emphasis is not in the original. So, in short, this passage is saying that living things are more alike than different, that all things made of blood and chi have these similarities. So, again, we're more alike to birds and beasts than different. And, again, there's much that could be said about this passage, but time, alas, does not permit doing so. So here we have, then, a portrayal of a continuum among living things that puts the Zhuangzi and the Liezi at odds with implicit or explicit hierarchies of living things, what we might call scales of nature, in a number of other warring states, and also, one should add, Greek texts. Now I'm going to, in the comparative spirit, talk a little bit about zoogenies in early Greek texts. And I can only do so briefly in the interest of time, but I think that for comparative purposes, it's worth introducing this. A number of early Greek zoogenies, that is, accounts of the birth of living things, describe animal life arising from the interaction of earth and water. And some emphasize also continuities between humans and animal kinds. Xenophanes, for example, the great one of the great philosophers among the physiologoi, or inquirers into nature, sometimes unfortunately described as pre-Socratics, Xenophanes held that life arose through interactions between earth and water, and the evidence of fossils of which he was aware, in his view, supported this. And again, these are all fragments, these early bits, so we don't have extended essays or descriptions. According to Anaxagoras, animals initially arose from moisture, but later from one another. Now, this is interesting because we're beginning to get the, if you like, prequel to accounts of evolution or something like evolution among living things. And I'll come back to that later on. Now, early accounts of human-animal continuity get a very different form in Aristotle's account of the faculties of the soul. Aristotle describes the soul as the first principle of all animal life, arche to zoon, in De Anima, or On the Soul. He describes it as the first actuality of a natural body that potentially has life. He describes the soul as inseparable of the body and as the cause and principle of the living body. Now, the important point here is that these descriptions are not unique to humans. We think of only humans as having souls, whereas Aristotle thought as faculties of the soul that that went from the ability to take in nutrition and reproduce, which even amoebae can do, to rationality, which he felt was confined largely to human beings. More on this later in a moment. Now, early accounts, now there's much more to be said about these passages, but I'm not going to try it today. Now, in general, these passages emphasize the continuity of living things, both the Chinese and the Greek ones. Whoops, I'm jumping again here. Despite Aristotle's commitment elsewhere to human uniqueness and also to the fixity of species. I'll come back to this later. It's also noteworthy, and again, time doesn't permit pursuing it in detail, that several Chinese accounts of human-animal continuity are based on claim of similar constitution of blood and qi, as we've already seen. Now I'm going to turn to another account of human-animal continuity, which are theories of transformation or evolution. And I put it this way because after we look at the text, we can decide which one we mean. And I'm going to give the game away and say that these turn out to be transformation more of evolution than evolution. But they sort of look like evolution as well. We find, again, primarily in texts that are traditionally classified as Taoist, accounts of a notion of destiny being shared by humans and animals in which we find transformation or evolution from one type of animal to another, including to humans. These theories describe the transformation of populations through time and how existing species have changed, not necessarily for the better, from biological ancestors. Now, let's remember that the term evolution can refer both to interspecies evolution, that is, from one species to another, the creation of new species through the accumulations of change over time, which is the Darwinian account, or also intra-species evolution, that is, variation within a species that does not result in the development of new species. Now, evolution in the strict sense of the term requires both descent with modification and natural selection. So I want to now turn to passages also in the Zhuangzi and Liezi that describe the transformation of qi. Almost a century ago, the great Chinese scholar Hu Shi made the important point that theories of qi introduce issues of potentiality and actuality. The idea that all actualizations are contained in the potential of qi introduces the possibility of theories of biological evolution. If all organisms arise from some kind of elemental or generative qi, then this must contain the potential for all later forms. Furthermore, Hu Shi argued that Warring States thinkers recognized organic continuity through the gradations of the animate world, beginning with undifferentiated qi and culminating in humanity. And this view of qi, by the way, also makes comprehensible a number of the paradoxes at the end of the Zhuangzi, but again, time doesn't permit discussing that. Now, this view of qi as transformative also offers a perspective on several Warring States and Han accounts of the evolution of living things in two specific senses of the term evolution. One, the notion that some types of living things descended from others, and two, that living things change by adapting to the environment. In particular, several passages in the Zhuangzi describe some kind of transformation or evolution of living things, of which the Ming of living things is presumably a part. So, we have one passage. This one is in the Zhuangzi, which says, we may discuss the principles of the myriad creatures. The life of living things is like the galloping of a horse, changing every moment, moving every moment. What do they do? What do they not do? They transform of themselves. Now, Hu Shi interprets this to mean that all things are species which develop into each other, or that develop into another, through processes of variation in forms. But it's not clear that this brief passage will support Hu Shi's interpretation. We have a more extended discussion in the chapter Ultimate Felicity of the Zhuangzi, that is Zhuangzi 18, which ends with an elaborate account of how species transform into one another under the influence of different environments. So again, these passages nuance the idea that species have heaven allotted years. So let me turn now, and this is a complex passage. Some of the species in it are quite strange. And again, time is not going to permit going through it in detail. So species, Jung, have germs, Ji. When they reach water, they become minute organisms, or literally filaments. When they reach the border of the water, that is moving from water to land, when they reach the border of water and land, they become, well, it's been translated as algae, but it's literally the clothing of frogs and oysters. When they germinate in elevated places, that is moving from the border of the water further into land, they become lingxi, which is, we don't know quite that what that is. And when the lingxi reached fertilized soil, it becomes crow's foot, wuzu. The crow's foot roots become some sort of grub called the qicao, and its leaves become butterflies. This is one of these things you don't get in introductions to Chinese philosophy. We're only getting started. The butterflies suddenly transform into insects. Think of Zhuangzi's dream, that live under the kitchen stove. They have the appearance of new-grown skin and are called chutuo. After 1,000 days, the chutuo become birds called ganyugu, whose saliva becomes some kind of an insect called the simi. The simi comes a kind of some kind of a wine fly called the shishi, which gives birth to something called the ilu. Huangguang are produced from the jiuyou, and monad gnats are born from putrid huan bugs. Again, much more, it's a strange passage, and there's a limit to what we can do with it. But the point for our purposes of all these strange insects is we have species transforming from one into another. The yangshi plant couples with bamboo that is not shooted for a long time, and the bamboo produces the green ning plant. Now, note at this point, we've only been talking about plants and insects, right? And we've gone on for some time. It's some confusion. The green ning plant produces panthers. Panthers produce horses. Horses produce humans. That was fast, wasn't it? Humans return to germs. G. And all living things come from germs and return to germs. Now, I consulted a number of sources on this translation, and it's really very problematic. Actually, I'm going to let me not get to that one yet. So we have this very strange account of species transformation. And also the notion that we go up the ladder to humans and then somehow return to germs. So this seems like a cycle. So it's not clear we can even call it evolution. This may be a cyclical transformation. Now again, and another variant of this passage occurs in the Liezi, which I'm not going to try to take you through. It needs to be stressed that both passages are extremely obscure and pose any number of hermeneutic problems that time doesn't permit going into. Nonetheless, in both versions, humans arise from and return to germs. And as such, these passages describe repeating cycles of transformation rather than evolution. Nonetheless, they indicate two very interesting points. First, they depict living things evolving from minute creatures to plants, insects, birds, animals, and humans. Second, these transformations occur not spontaneously, but in response to different physical environments, moving from water to land, to higher parts on land and to fertilized soil. Third, they occur over time, though that point isn't emphasized. Now, we have another account of possible evolution in the Liezi that is not in the Zhuangzi. Ready for another strange one. So there is that which reproduces and that which does not. There is that which changes and that which doesn't change. What does not reproduce can produce what does reproduce. What does not change can transform into what does change. But what reproduces cannot not reproduce, and what changes cannot not change. Therefore, they constantly reproduce and constantly change. What for what constantly reproduces and constantly changes, there is no time that it does not reproduce and no time when it does not change. And this is a wonderful exercise in parallel prose, isn't it, for those of you who are familiar with this type of writing. Now, yin and yang are thus, the four seasons are thus. What does not reproduce is fixed and unitary. What does not change comes and goes. What comes in, as to what comes and goes, its limits are endless. As to what is fixed and unitary, its Tao is boundless. And as you can see, by the way, some of this is verse. Some of it is parallel prose, some of it is verse. Now, this passage contrasts things that reproduce and change with things that do not, but the things that do not cause, catalyze reproduction and change. And Husha, by the way, describes this very problematically as monads. Part of the problem with Husha's very interesting account of these passages is he's trying to somehow assimilate them into late 19th century, early 20th century Western philosophy, and I think it's a complicated thing to try to do and not entirely successful. Another subject that could be discussed, but not today. The contrast, however, continues. Wait a second. There's another part here that I didn't do a slide for because I do want to move on, but it's but the passage continues. Therefore, there is that which reproduces and that which produces the reproducing. There are forms and that which forms the forms. There are colors and that which colors the colors. There are sounds and that which makes the sounds. There are tastes and that which constitutes the taste. What is reproduced may die. Get back to our years allotted by heaven, right? But what produces the reproducing never dies. The forms may become real, but what forms the forms is never manifest. The sounds can be heard, but what makes the sounds is never shown. The colors can be visible, but what colors the colors is never seen. The taste can be tasted, but what constitutes the taste is never manifest. And the passage finally concludes by identifying this primal material with the action. Oh, sorry, I do have this. Wait a moment. Excuse me. No? Sorry, I'm going backwards. The passage concludes by identifying the primal material with wu wei, or acting without acting, and with a series of apparent opposites. So all of this is the offices of wu wei. It can yin or it can yang. It can soften or harden, lengthen or shorten, square or round, bring to life or kill. Wonderful collections of parallel verbs, by the way, for those interested in classical Chinese grammar. Warm or chill, float or sink. It can sound the gong tone or the sheng tone. It can emerge or submerge, darken or brighten, that is literally blacken or yellow. It can make things sweet or bitter, foul or fragrant. It is without knowledge and without capability, yet there is nothing that it does not know or cannot do, this primal stuff that causes these other things. Now, importantly, the Lianzi passage then identifies this generative force with Tao and the action of Wu Wei. It describes then a generative force that does not change or reproduce, but generates everything that does change and reproduce. So we have then a very, very complicated account of, if you like, the initiation of life and the transformation of species in the Lianzi, and one that is very problematic and complex. I'm again, however, going to turn to early Greek texts that also deal with the birth of living things, and in particular the birth of humankind. But before doing so, let me wrap up with three key points. First of all, that Chinese and Greek zoogenies, that is, accounts of the birth of living things, seem to describe transformation, not evolution in the strict sense. Secondly, that we will find a tension between material and teleological accounts of species change. And thirdly, we can note the broader cosmological role of zoogeny, that is the creation of living things, and anthropogeny, the creation of humans, in the notion, in balance and interactions of complementary forces, that is yin-yang in the Chinese case and qi, and the Empedoclean four elements in the Greek case. Now I'm going to talk very briefly about some anthropogenies of Anaximander, Empedocles, and Plato. The Physiologos Anaximander describes the cosmos coming to be out of the boundless, to apeiron, something that we might want to compare to Tao, including the emergence of the earth, stars, and the generation of life. So the generation of life, zoogeny, comes out of the boundless, to apeiron. He describes the origins of humans as the transformation of another species, probably some kind of fish. I don't have a slide for this, but Anaximander of Miletus conceived that there arose from heated water and earth either fish or creatures very like fish. In these, humans grew in the form of embryos retained within until puberty. Then at last the fish-like creatures burst, and men and women who were already able to nourish themselves stepped forth. This is, of course, an account of gestation rather than evolution, since the fish are the parents rather than the ancestors of humans who are capable of nourishment at birth. Anaximander also introduces what became the very widely held view that life was generated from the action of heat on water and earth. Now, Empedocles describes the creation of animals and humans from random limbs produced by the earth under the influence of love and strife, two opposing forces. In his version of natural selection, the earth produces shoots of men and women, and these whole nature forms, in Greek hulafues, lacked limbs and language. There were also human-animal amalgams, that is, combinations of human and animal parts, including human-faced ox progeny and ox-headed humans. Here, the same forces of love and strife produce both animals and humans. Empedocles makes no strong distinction between zoogeny, that is the creation of living things, and anthropogeny, the creation of human beings, given these amalgams. Humans and animals not only have the same origin, but continue to be fundamentally similar. Empedocles' account of the productions of humans and animals adds two new elements to our story: that creatures and their parts arise in a random way, and that the transformation into species occurred through the extinction of non-viable combinations. And this is a view later echoed by Aristotle. Now, insofar as love and strife create these component limbs and bits and bobs at random, Empedocles positions chance and necessity as the driving force between zoogeny. Interestingly, not fate, because we can think of chance as the opposite of fate in some sense. Combinations of features arose by chance in Empedocles' account. Necessity and chance determined what became extinct. That is, necessity determined what couldn't make it. And chance, the combination of chance and necessity together, determined what could adapt and live and what could survive. These accounts, notice, are non-teleological, in contrast with the zoogenies of Plato and Aristotle, which move toward the purpose, namely the creation of human beings. I'm going to actually skip a bit here on Plato and Aristotle in the interests of time. So then Greek accounts show oppositions, again, on three questions. The question of transformation or evolution, the tension between materialistic and teleological accounts, and I haven't really gone through the Platonic material, and the interacting relations of zoogeny and anthropology. Now, comparing these debates, the Chinese and the Greek, highlights again three important points the ones that I've already mentioned. Now, by contrast, the Zhuangzi and the Liezi give an explicit account of interspecies transformation over time. While the return to germs in the Zhuangzi passage, that the strange one, tends to undermine an evolutionary force in these accounts, they nevertheless portray animals adapting and changing in response to different environments, as do the Greek accounts. And in particular, the transformation moving from water to land. The passages stress, the Chinese and the Greek, the mutability of living things, changing spontaneously, as it were, like the galloping of a horse. There is no pre-existing model, no pre-existing telos, to contain the number of possible species. And the Liezi describes both what reproduces and what does not reproduce. Further, all the Greek accounts describe the emergence of order out of chaos in positive terms, associating order with the gods, and this is in passages in Hesiod that I haven't discussed, and also in accounts of the divine craftsmen in Plato and Aristotle, which I also haven't discussed. The Zhuangzi and Liezi, by contrast, seem to valorize original chaos, that is, we return back to the germs, rather than the emergence of order. And they associate this original chaos with Tao and with the action of Wu Wei, that is, acting without acting. It's also striking that these detailed accounts of zoogeny are, I think we can say, broadly Taoist. Shunzi, who I'll talk about later, gives a very different picture. So I'm now going to turn to my third theme in this account of the relations between humans and animals, that is what we might call scales of nature. That is, scales of increasing order and hierarchy in nature. Because, of course, the Zhuangzi and Liezi accounts of evolution are just the opposite. It's a cycle. Nothing is particularly better than anything else. Now, before talking about scales of nature, I want to emphasize that Charles Darwin described evolution as a scale of nature. He says, the inhabitants of each successive period in the world's history have beaten their predecessors in the race for life and are, insofar, higher in the scale of nature. And this may account for that vague yet ill-defined sentiment felt by many paleontologists that organization on the whole has progressed. So a scale of nature, then, is an explicit series of steps from lowest to highest, inevitably, it would seem, ending with humans, spirit people, or gods. Chinese scales of nature seem to organize around two distinct principles. One is ethics, and one is technological distinctions between humans and animals. Greek scales of nature are linked with teleologies of Plato and Aristotle, specifically giving an account that ends with the creation of humans. However, let me turn first to Chinese scales of nature. Warring States' Chinese texts differ considerably on whether there is an ascending order of living things. Those that assert a scale of nature all put humans at the top, but for different reasons. The Shunzi describes an ascending scale of nature of specifically ethical faculties. And this is, I think, a well-known passage. Pardon me, I get rid of Skype here. Sorry about that. Water and fire have qi, but no procreation. Grasses and trees have procreation, but no capacity to know. Birds and beasts, we're getting back to the human-animal continuity, have the capacity to know, but not a sense of righteousness, not the capacity to behave ethically. Humans have qi, procreation, knowledge, and also the capacity to behave correctly. Therefore, they are the most honored in the world. So here we have an ascending scale of nature based on ethics, and this is what we might expect from Shunzi. This scale of living things makes a set of distinction between non-living things, which have qi, plants, which have life without awareness, animals, which have awareness without morality, and humans, who have it all. The Zhuangzi contrasts then to the Shunzi in a number of important ways. First of all, it is not teleological, as we've seen. The human beings go back to germs. The Zhuangzi, in other passages, which time again doesn't permit discussing, recommends animals as models because of their freedom from destructive emotions. Animals don't fret over changes in their environment and are not upset by illusory shifts of emotions as humans are. However, the Zhuangzi does grant that humans have the power to determine or alter their Ming, their destiny, that animals do not. Only humans can optimize our Ming in order to live out our full lifespan. Now, warring states and Han texts also include other more general accounts of human superiority over animals. Humans and animals are both composed as blood and, of blood and qi, as we've seen, but one is fine qi and the other is coarse qi. But the claim that humans among animals are the apex of an ascending scale is not uncontroversial in early China. In addition to the general account of human-animal continuity that we've discussed, at least one text, again the Liezi, specifically argues that humans and animals are equal. At a sacrificial, in an account of a sacrificial feast by Duc Dien of Qi, the host asserts that heaven has provided the five grains, fish and birds, for use by humans, but a young boy disagrees. He argues that the myriad living things, Wan Wu, of heaven and earth, are born equally with us, in kind, in lay, that is, in class. Class in the sense of classification, not in the sense of social class. These kinds do not have the hierarchy of highborn and low, that is, noble and base, and it is only that they overpower each other by greater and lesser intelligence and strength. They eat each other by turns, but it is not the case that one is born for the use of another. We humans seize what we can and eat them. But how can we say that heaven originally gave birth to them for our sakes? Besides, mosquitoes and gnats bite us. Tigers and wolves eat our flesh. But did heaven originally produce humans for the sake of mosquitoes and gnats, or produce our flesh for the sake of tigers and wolves? The Huainanzi takes an opposite view from this passage with two arguments that animals belong to separate categories or species, again this term lei, and that humans are superior. In one, the separate species argument is explicit, but is not linked to claims for human superiority. So first of all, talking about separate species, that birds and beasts do not gather in the same places because they belong to different lei, that is, to different classes or species. That tigers and deer do not travel together is because their strength is unequal. In another passage, a fox and a raccoon dog do not differ as they belong to the same class of animals, but if you call a fox a raccoon dog, you do not know either one. Now, some Huainanzi accounts of species and categories reflect these taxonomies of blood and qi, in which species differentiate as a result of the differentiation of the qi of which they're composed. Others account for species difference using the terms of yin-yang and wu-xing, terms that will be very familiar to all the China specialists in the room, and taxonomies based on yin-yang and wu-xing, or five agents. But others seem to suggest a scale of nature in which species differentiate through different capabilities. In one passage, the myriad living things are all born to different kinds. For example, silkworms eat but don't drink, cicadas drink but don't eat, mayflies neither eat nor drink. Animals and scaly creatures eat during the summer but hibernate during the winter. So here we have an attempt to use behavior, specifically eating and drinking, as a way of discriminating different classes without reference to blood or qi or yin or yang. As John Major points out, the passage moves, however, from so-called lower animals through oviparous animals and mammals, suggesting but not emphasizing a hierarchical taxonomy. But as the scale moves from animal to human, Human nature specifically includes the intelligence and artifice that allows humans to control animals for human purposes. Remember, this discussion began with humans cutting off other living things from their natural years allotted by heaven. So here we have an account in the Huainanzi of how humans are able to do that. Though their claws and teeth are sharp and their muscles and bones are strong, animals cannot avoid being controlled by people because they cannot communicate their intelligence to one another, and their abilities and strength cannot be unified. So here, the superiority is not something inherent or God-given, but some practical one, that our not only our intelligence, but our use of language allows us to deploy our abilities in ways that animals cannot. Notice it's not saying that animals lack intelligence, but that they cannot unify their intentions. In another passage, tigers and leopards are faster, black bears and brown are stronger, but people eat their meat and make mats of their skins. Why? Because animals are not able to communicate their knowledge and unite their strength. So this is a very different account than that of the Shunza as to why humans are superior. Remember, the Shunza scale of nature was an ethical one. This one is a technological one. And so these passages then emphasize not the technological skill to create artifacts, which humans also possess from the bodies of animals and otherwise, but the technical capability of having language. Of course, these passages don't deal with the question of animal language, but nonetheless, I think we can agree that human language is further developed than animal language in unifying our abilities. This argument is also distinct from other claims of the Homo faber type, that is, that technology, the ability to make artifacts, is what separates humans from animals, since here the difference is not artifacts but language. For example, in the Mozi and many accounts of the civilizing activity of sages, the key difference is technology, but here notice it's language. Now, when we contrast the taxonomy of the Zhuangzi to these Huainanzi passages, when we contrast the account of transforming qi to these accounts, this adds to our understanding of the Zhuangzi's account of responses to Ming or destiny. The account of Ming as lifespan for a continuum of living things allows the Zhuangzi to suggest a taxonomy of animals, humans, and spirit people, Shenren, that differs in important ways from the taxonomies of the Shunza or the Huainanzi, which is, of course, after the Zhuangzi. Humans are not distinctive in the Zhuangzi because of their moral sense, as they are in Shunza, or because of their intelligence and mastery of language. And those of you who know the Zhuangzi, it makes a great deal of fun of language, although it uses it very skillfully. The key difference, however, I would argue, is agency. The ability to make individual choices that allow us to live out our allotted lifespan. This is what the Zhuangzi emphasizes, unlike the Shunza or the Huainanzi. But on the Zhuangzi's account, we should use our unique human facilities, but not at the cost of forgetting our continuities with living things, not at the cost of abusing animals and plants with which we are similar. The Zhuangzi then seems to want to retain more of our animal nature than these other texts, but because it is natural, and it provides in this sense that our animal nature provides an antidote to false desires and attachments that obscure Tao and interfere with our individual autonomy. So the Zhuangzi then would have us reason that at a certain point put it aside. Now, having talked at some length about scales of nature and disagreements about them in early China, let me just turn to one very famous scale of nature in ancient Greece. Remember that before, Aristotle talked about faculties of the soul that were common to both humans and animals. Aristotle also states that faculties of the soul are like a series of figures in which the earlier forms prefigure the later. And he, in particular, describes a scale of nature culminating in the human faculty of reasoning. That is, the first faculty of the soul are the ability to take nutrition and to reproduce, or in Greek, threptikon, which all living things share. The second is the ability to sense things and sensation and perception in Greek, to aesthetikon, which we share with some animals. Next, the faculty of experiencing desire, aretikon, which we also share with many animals. Then the capacity for locomotion, kineton, katatopon, that is moving towards something, which we share with many animals. Finally, imagination, fantasia, which we also share with some animals. Aristotle believes that some animals can imagine. And finally, nous, or to dina noetikon, or reason, which we do not share with animals. Although even here, Aristotle believes that some animals have practical reason. And if I can then quote just one passage, I don't have a slide for it, from De Anima. Finally and most rare are reason and thought. For those perishable beings, that is all mortal things, who have reason and thought, and also have all the other faculties of the soul, have reason. Some do not have imagination, others live solely by it. Now, Aristotle argues in Book 3 of De Anima that all animals perceive, but very few imagine. Non-human animals may have imagination, but none have reason. Some animals have the ability to form mental images, but lack understanding. Imagination may be based on sensation, or as it is with animals, or on reason, as it only is with humans. From these passages, we see that Aristotle saw animals as part of a hierarchy of existence, or a scale of nature, with human beings at the apex. And this is another major difference between his views and the account of humans, animals, and Ming in the Zhuangzi and several other Chinese taxonomies. Let's see. I think that time is pressing, so I'm going to skip over a couple of smaller points and move to my conclusions, because this is repeating things that we've already said. We're now then in a position to reassess early Chinese Greek accounts and Greek accounts of lifespan, evolution, and fate. And several areas of broad consensus bear remark. In both traditions, we find a dominant view that humans evolved from animals. This view is perhaps surprisingly widespread, despite many disagreements on the details. Also perhaps surprising is the prevalence of the idea that living things evolved in response to environments, and that maladapted species die out. Secondly, we find a widespread view that humans share a common nature and common faculties with other animals, and in one case, the Zhuangzi, including the notion of having a destiny or an allotted lifespan. Among this list, the Zhuangzi account of Ming is distinctive because its criterion for having a Ming is mortality, not humanity. It articulates a different conceptual relation to animals than do the other continuum theories that we've surveyed today at perhaps tiresome length. But for all of its egalitarianism, the Zhuangzi restricts the possibility of optimizing our Ming to humans. The tree cannot transform its wood. The animal cannot transform its nature. This account of Ming is also consistent with the rejection of scales of nature based on human morality or human technology. Nonetheless, most of these texts that we've looked at today, and it's quite a number, do consider humans in some sense distinct from and superior to other animals for a wide variety of reasons. Finally, accounts of humans and animals, including taxonomies, are pervasively informed by cosmological theories, and again, time doesn't permit discussing this in detail, including Greek four-element theories and Chinese theories of yin-yang and qi. Equally noteworthy is the extent of disagreement within each tradition, which I think we've already seen bits of, and again, much more could be said. But on that note, I'm going to conclude and thank you for your time and attention.